And I, but I think that there's a lot of really new ways of thinking about mechanics. So I kind of want to go over stuff again, because it takes a while, I think, to get used to some of the intuition that you should maybe start to build with this theory, and also to believe, you know, that this is actually an implementation of Mach's principle. So why don't I just summarize some things to you yesterday? This is some stuff from last time. And the main idea is that we're looking for a metric on shape space. So we're looking for a way to be able to tell the difference between shapes. So the first thing, that's the idea, metric on the space of shapes. And the way that we do this is we embed the shape into a Euclidean coordinate system. And then, well, we embed two shapes into a Euclidean coordinate system. And then we shift around one of them until we get the points as close as we can together. So that's the idea. So the way to find this metric is actually to introduce this artificial coordinate system and then sort of match the two shapes as best as we can. Which is why it's called best matching. And we shift shapes using these auxiliary fields, which last time I called omega. It turns out that the way to implement this idea is equivalent to just looking in your action. So you have some action defined on some Euclidean coordinates. And then you take all the derivatives with respect to your parameter lambda, or your canonical variable, and you turn them into something that looks like a covariant derivative, where covariant derivative looks like this, d by d lambda plus a piece that looks like omega dot alpha t alpha. And these omegas are, you can think of them as the generators of some group. Not the generators, the parameters of some group. And the t's are generators. P, x, p, omega alpha, t alpha is an element of some symmetry group. And that's the symmetry group that you're really trying to mod out. In this theory. So that's the philosophy. Now, one thing that's very different, you'll notice this guy would be the guy that you would say if you were doing gauge theory, this would be a piece that would be related to the gauge connection. But because it's the derivative of something, we'll see later that it's like a flat connection. It's a connection with zero curvature. And that's, to me, that's what best matching is. It's a definition of a connection with zero curvature. That's what we were trying to do. But there are some peculiarities. Right? There's a couple weird things. When you do a variation of the action with respect to these omegas, you do it in such a way that you keep the omegas, the variation of the omegas, free on the boundary. So the idea is that, I mean, if you have some configuration space, and you've got all of these equivalence classes of shapes. So, you know, a point here could be some shape, and a point here would be the same shape but rotated or translated in some direction. What you want to do is you want to allow for translation, for the same translations and rotations at the boundary. So in order to do that, you allow the omegas to be free fields, the boundary as well. And this implies a slightly different variational principle than what we're used to. Instead of having the Euler-Lagrange equations, you have the Euler-Lagrange equations plus this extra condition, which is that the derivative of the action with respect to omega dot is equal to 0.
Right. What's the boundary here?
The boundary would just be two instances of time. So so the initial state and the final state of some system. So two shapes macroscopically separated by something. So this is when you're setting up your variational principle. That's what you need to do. If you're setting up a pattern, you have an in-state and an out-state. This would be the in-state, this would be the out-state. Mm-hmm. So that's, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Or if you're just comparing two macroscopically distinct states, one would be the first shapes, not state, shape. One would be the first shape, second would be the second shape. And then you're trying to go along this infinitesimal sort of slices between them. That's the issue.
No, that's all right.
Okay. So,
so the action would just be an integral between those two times.
Yeah. So, but they're not really times. They're just, there's sort of instants or moments or configurations of the universe, right? So all the points in this configuration space are just different configurations. And of course, Julian's way of thinking about this is that you can sort of see all those configurations instantaneously and stuff. But the whole theory is based on the action principle. And in order to have an action principle, we need to have boundaries. So this is that extra condition here. And in fact, if you were to, what I'll show today is that this thing is the thing that's really making the theory relational and background independent. If you were to take this away, it would be like reintroducing a background. So we'll get this. So you'll see, physically you can see why. If we specify a particular omega here and here, what we've effectively done is we've fixed some boundary conditions. We've said this amount of, this shape has to be rotated exactly by this much by the end of this whole thing. So that in that sense, it's getting background back. But we'll see more of that later. Now, the third point was that, so once we have a metric, then we can define our action. So the metric leads to a Jacobi action. And we looked at these earlier. The Jacobi action is just the metric times some conformal factor. And this thing is like interpreted as the potential. So for the theory of particles that we're looking at, it's E minus B, which is a function of the Qs. But in a more general theory context, it can be just any function of the configuration space. So in general relativity, for example, this is going to be the three curvature of the three metric minus the cosmological constant. So the thing that was playing the role of E is playing the role of the cosmological constant of gravity. The thing that's playing the role of the potential here is the curvature. So this is how you construct the action. And then we can do those equations of motion. So what we found when we did the variations is that if we do the variations of this guy with respect to the q's and we set that equal to 0, so this is a normal variation. We get in a particular gauge, we set a gauge like this, and we found that this is just Newton's, this just gives Newton's lines.
Sean, just to remind me, the qi's are the points in the absolute configuration space.
That's right.
And I is a label of particles.
Yes. So this big I is a particle label, and the q's are the coordinates of that particle. And I haven't been writing a little vector sign on top, but I'm just assuming that they're row vectors. And it makes the math more easier. So that's what this opposite configuration space is. It's the configuration space of this opposite form of Euclidean coordinates. So this thing is just, this variation gives Newton's laws, but with this ephemeris time. So this is the same theory that we got at the beginning of the course when we just looked at the Jacobian theory. You have this emergent time that is energy dependent, and so we're sort of this Jacobian principle is doing what we want to do. It's implementing temporal relations. But we also have another variation, which is with respect to these omegas, and this is the sort of strange variation I talked about, freedom point variation. And what this guy implied was that we have various conserved quantities that are set equal to zero. So the total angular momentum of this system is equal to zero. The total linear momentum is equal to zero. And we have this thing called the dilatational momentum, which is p dot q is equal to zero. And this is the total thing, so for the whole system. And this is a sort of generic thing. You can prove that anytime you have this symmetry, it's going to imply another current. And what this theory is doing is it's just setting those equal to zero. So the idea is that normally those nether currents would be specified by the boundary conditions. So we would have some theory, we'd have some initial state, we'd have some final state, and then that would tell us what the total momentum had to be. Compute that based on the initial state, what would be the total momentum of the universe. In this theory, we're saying, well, now we can no longer do that. We can no longer fix these nether currents using the boundary conditions because they're required by this principle to be equal to zero. And that's the thing that is really getting rid of the background currents. Now there's no dependence on, so this guy's interesting. What it's saying is that you can't just take the system and arbitrarily start to translate it in one direction. That's not a physical thing to do. What we really want to do is just have that equal to zero, or have a principle that tells us that this thing's fixed to something. And the most natural thing for us to be is zero. The same thing with the angular momentum. We can't just take the system and arbitrarily start rotating it in some direction. That's not going to be, there's no physical meaning in doing that. So that's where these constraints are coming from. And I think that what I want to do is maybe talk a little bit more about the consequences of this. Okay. So effectively what we have is we have Newtonian theory with these constraints applied. That's what the Newtonian theory is. Now why do we call that a relation theory? So, let me go all the way back. So, what are the consequences, right? I'm going to go all the way back to Newton's bucket. Maybe I'll just refresh old memory on this. This is an experiment that you can do. And that Newton sort of famously talked about in his Principia, where you have this bucket in sort of four different stages of motion. And the bucket has some water in it. Okay. In the first stage, nothing's happening. The bucket and the water are stationary. And so what you get is you have this like flat sort of surface of water. So this is sort of stage one. In stage two, what you do is you start rotating the bucket by sort of spinning the string that the bucket is attached to. And when you do that, at first, the water hasn't started to move yet. So there is some relative motion between the bucket and the water. And but the water is still flat. So then what you might want to try to do is have a table of sort of relative motion and whether or not the thing is flat, the water is flat. So this is the physical effect that you observe. Right? So in the first case, you have no relative motion, and you have, and yes, the water is flat. In the second case, you have relative motion, but the water is not flat. So here you have this sort of the water is still flat. So here you have this sort of strange situation where for two different physical states of the system, you're getting the same result. So so if you're concerned with, if you want to create a relational theory, you would expect that these two different situations should have different physical results. But that's not what's happening. And then you can even take this further, and you can sort of imagine that after some time, because of friction, the water is going to start catching up to the walls of the bucket. And so now both the bucket and the water are moving together. And now, because of the centrifugal forces, the water is going to be creeping up the sides of the bucket. So now you have no relative motion again because they're moving together. And now the thing is not flat. And in the last stage, what you have is you stop the bucket and the water keeps going. So now there is no motion of the bucket, but there is motion of the water, and the water is still creeping up the side. So now you have, yes, there is relative motion, and again, you still have not flat. So you can see that there's all kinds of contradictions here. That the relational motion is not really dictating the physical outcome of the experiment. And so Newton used this as a criticism of a criticism of relational theories and a proof that absolute space exists. That it's the motion relative to absolute space that is giving you these physical effects. Okay. So what is the resolution? Well, if you remember, what Mach said was that really your universe is not created with is not just composed of a bucket with some water in it. There's other things in the universe. In fact, there's a lot of other things in the universe. And in particular, there's fixed stars everywhere. So there's very massive stellar objects. And what he said is that if you're trying to create a true relational theory, you need to take into account everything in the universe. And the presence of these fixed stars is creating a sort of absolute frame of rest, because it's the motion of this water with respect to the average sort of position of all these stars that's really important. When you're talking about relational motion, you should be talking about the motion of the water and the body with respect to everything else, in which case you could, in some principle, get a consistent theory. Now, the problem is that Mach never really wrote down an actual theory where this principle was carried out. So we had to wait until 1980 for an actual consistent version of such a theory. And that's what this is, so I'm claiming the rest of this is. And the way that we see that, so the first thing that I want to do is to show you that this theory is really radically different from the theories that we're used to. So in such a theory, there's no angular momentum. So what that means is that there's only two possible situations. So I don't know, Julia Barber's bucket, right? So this is Barber's bucket in a world where there's only a bucket and a water, right? So here, the angular momentum of the bucket plus the angular momentum of the water is constrained to be equal to zero because the universe is formed out of those two things. So there's only two possibilities. One is we have nothing moving, no relative motion of anything, in which case we get some sort of flat. We expect to have some sort of flat water, right? Because nothing is happening. And the second situation would be that the angular momentum of the bucket is equal to minus the angular momentum of the water. Origin reduced mean that the bucket is spinning one way and the water is spinning the other way. So then we would have something like this, and then the water would be, the bucket might be spinning like this, and the water might be spinning like that, and now the water is turning from the sides. So these are the two situations. And now if we draw the same table, relative motion and flat, we find a very different thing. In the first situation, there is no relative motion, and the water is flat, yes. And in the second situation, there is relative motion, and the water is not flat. So now, the relative motion between the two is, in fact, given different physical situations. And these are encompassing all the different possible things.
Why do you say that it will necessarily go the signs? I mean, you solve it, you
choose one. Well, I mean, ultimately, you have to solve it with a theory, right? I'm just...
But if you do that,
if
it doesn't
you,
really
you
go
that, I'm not sure. I am sure, because really this is just Newton's laws, right? So you can sort of go to, there's sort of like a preferred frame in these. I mean, ultimately these theories are embedded in some sort of Euclidean frame. So the preferred frame that we would go to here would be frame with this bucket and water at rest. And then here we would just go to the frame. If the water is moving this way, the other guys would now make where their angle went to zero. And then you would just have the same predictions in Newtonian physics. So you have the same forces acting. So I haven't done the calculation, but you wouldn't get any different result from.
I mean, there you have just Newtonian predictions, and you can say you get both. When you have relative motion, sometimes it's better, sometimes it's not.
Yeah, but the point is that the difference between this theory is that it's not angular. There is angular momentum in the system, right? So in this case, well, there's no angular momentum. That's true. But here there is some angular momentum of the bucket. In this case, there's also angular momentum, because you picked a frame. You haven't picked the frame with angular momentum is zero, right? So you picked the frame with angular momentum is non-zero, which is why one and three are both nodes, but they're giving different results. So that is allowed in the Newtonian framework. In the Barber framework, that's not allowed. You're not allowed to do that, because you need to have a full angular momentum equal to zero. So situations like one versus three cannot arise. They're sort of not part of the solutions of the Barber theory, which is basically these constraints are saying that there's a whole bunch of solutions in Newtonian theory that do not exist in the relational theory. And it's very apparent when you only have two particles. But one thing that this maybe might become clear is that the more particles you have in the system, the harder it is to tell the difference between the relational theory and the absolute theory. And the reason is because these constraints do not grow with the number of particles, right? These are seven constraints. If I keep adding particles, there's sort of more and more things that can happen. But now I'm just using those seven constraints to constrain the number of particles to the 3 degrees of freedom. Every time I add a new particle, I get 3 more degrees of freedom. So if you have a large amount of particles, then that large amount of particles to the 3 minus 7 is still very close to the number of degrees you have for the two theories. So now, let me just say one more thing about this that might help. Mach's resolution here is to talk about stars. So what if we talked about stars?
Can I ask a question about the C? You said the reason we know that this is what will happen in a Barber universe, a relational universe where there were only a bucket of water, is because we can ask what the solution would be in a Newtonian universe where the total angular momentum is zero.
That's right.
But it strikes me that I'm a bit confused. It would seem to me that the appropriate comparison would be if we go to our universe and we were to take the fixed stars and rotate them one way, and take the water in our bucket and rotate it another way in such a way that the total angular momentum relative to Newtonian absolute frame was zero.
That's right.
Then we would know how this experiment ought to turn out. But we can't rotate the fixed stars. I mean, rotating the bucket's no good, because actually the thing that's important for the inertia of the water in the real universe are the fixed stars, not the bucket.
Yeah. Well, like, adding the fixed stars is something more, right? Like, what we're really...
So I'm saying, what experiment in the real universe? It seems to me you're saying I don't need to do the calculation here. I know how it's going to work out because I can do an experiment in the real universe.
Oh no! Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think that follows because you can't make the total angular measurement.
The only reason why I said that is just because equations are the same. So like if I were to solve these equations, I would do is I write down the Newton's laws and I would say that the angular momentum has to be zero. So then that's why I would expect that you would get some sort of centrifugal force. Like, I can still use the machinery of Newtonian theory. I just have the angular momentum equal to zero. So that's why I know what to expect. Now, you're right, if I did a real world experiment, so it's the mathematics that's telling me.
I see.
Of course, so I haven't actually looked it up, but I mean, it would be fair. That's the way I would do it, and I think it's fairly easy to show. Now, if you did a real-world experiment, that's the thing, is you have all these fixed stars, right?
Right.
And so now, that's the major difference, and you know, if you do a real experiment and you put all these fixed stars, you have this issue that the mass of the stars is much, much, much greater than the mass of the bucket plus the mass of the water, right? So what you can do is... Now, you're kind of back to this situation. You can have all these other types of relative motion between the water and the stars, and the bucket and the stars. And the thing that happens is that the angular momentum of the water plus the angular momentum of the bucket can be non-zero, provided that the angular momentum of the fixed stars can balance whatever this is. So the thing that you need the angular momentum of the stars plus the angular momentum of the bucket plus the angular momentum of the water equal to zero. But because this is so massive, right, it's not hard for the angular momentum of this, for all the stars in the universe to absorb the angular momentum of the bucket and the water, right? And we would never be able to do a precise experiment that could determine how all that angular momentum is leaking into the stars. Because this is a large mass, the actual amount of rotation the stars have to do is so small that it would get there. So that's what saves the day. And in fact, once you add these fixed stars, you're back to the situation. So it's very difficult to distinguish between the predictions of the relational theory and the predictions of the absolute theory. Yes.
What about like rotating binary stars?
It's the same thing, right? The mass of the two binary stars compared to the mass of the matter in the rest of the universe is still very small.
Galaxies.
Rotation of galaxies. Yeah. I mean, then you start to get into problems. So maybe there are ways to test this, I don't know. But one of the problems with this particular model is that kind of in order to really make definite predictions, you need to know that the universe is in some sense closed. You need to have kind of like an island universe, a closed universe. You know that there's a fixed amount of particles. And, you know, for our universe, we're not sure if we have such a situation. So that is an assumption, but it's really important. In order for this to work, you need to know how many particles you have. So once you start getting to the scales of galaxy clusters and how they're rotating, then it becomes more complicated. I don't know, we have a cosmologist here. Like, is the angular momentum of the universe equal to zero? As far as we know.
I think it's quantum mechanical. It depends on whether the inflation or perturbations of Gaussian or not.
Okay.
So.
So it's hard to make measurements on that on the scale of the whole universe.
You're saying in relational theory you can only ever talk about the whole universe and you can't talk about subsystems?
No, so what you can do is if you know that you have something like an island universe where you have subsystems that are sufficiently isolated from the rest of things, then you can kind of treat that as a system on its own.
But I would consider in Wicket to be pretty isolated from big stars. I mean, how do you know what you can
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not isolated from Earth or something. But I mean, we could use the same arguments that this massive Earth, right, can sort of rotate to keep the bucket stable. So it could be the Earth that's created. Now, the analogous thing in general relativity is, according to Barber relational theory, is frame dragging. So in general relativity, when you have these large, massive objects, you have these like things that are approximately like rest frames that sort of follow the mass as it rotates around. And that's the analogous thing that's happening. So you can use this on sufficiently isolated systems. In the same way, I didn't really mention this, but with this affinity femurs time, if you have an isolated subsystem and they can measure somehow the energy of that subsystem, they calculate their femurs time. And then there's another subsystem that's sufficiently isolated as well, and they do the same thing. Those two clocks will march in step, which is they'll agree. So that's a really non-trivial thing, but it's actually a really nice property of this femurs time. And it's, I think, something that Barbara really questions. But I didn't mention that, but it's kind of a nice thing.
So just the last kind of point on this. So is it clear to you that this last constraint would be satisfied by a bucket of water rising at the side of the
water? No, this constraint is the thing that's fairly invisible. So far, it's very hard to create realistic theories of the universe that have this constraint that actually move this part. So this is the one situation where this thing is a result of scale invariance. And the scale invariance is the thing that is really hard to fit into these theories and make something that's actually gives good physical predictions. So the scale invariance is always an issue. And you know, from a foundational point of view, it probably should be there, right? If we just take, especially these particle models, if we have a system of particles and we change the scale, and what you have operational access to in that universe is just the ratios of things. You'll never be able to tell whether or not you've done this from scaling. But the problem is that experimentally, this theory doesn't really experiment. And hopefully, I can actually get to what this theory actually tells us. But anyway,
so this doesn't limit the potentials that the theory can have.
It does limit the potentials.
Have you noted it's even a non-trivial theory in the sense that I could have interactions between the particles?
Yeah, so the types of potentials that you can have in this theory, and hopefully I can get to that today, but it doesn't look like it all the time, but R of the form 1 over, there's some constant over R squared, and where R is the distances between R, I, J, capital I, capital J, so the distances between the particles squared, which is, I mean, if this was a 1, then it would be okay, because it would just be gravity, but with the 2, it's very strange. I think that's might be telling us that there's and of course when you do gravity, when you do the same thing for gravity, you get similar results to theories on physical forces. Constant cosmological, but it's a strange cosmological constant. And so that could be telling us that there's a fundamental scale in our universe. So I don't really know what that means, but it's an interesting point.
Is it still Machian even if you get rid of that scale?
Well, it would be Machian with respect to translations and rotations. It would mean that there's no absolute orientation of the universe. So there's no absolute zero point in the universe. If this was not true, then it would probably mean that there's some sort of fundamental scale, which might be the Planck scale or something. And maybe because of quantum mechanics we have, or quantum gravity, we have a fundamental scale. So I should say that Julian's put a lot of effort into trying to make theories with this type of scale invariance plausible. He's had some success in doing that. So the way I want to go now is I want to point out just a couple of the unfamiliar ideas, and then I'm going to do the canonical look at the Hamiltonian theory. And the reason is because the first time we went through, we did the Lagrangian, and I think the Lagrangian is kind of like a quick and dirty way of getting to these constraints. But the Hamiltonian, you really get to know the theory very well. And so so we can really see the structure, because there's some unfamiliar ideas. And I think they're worth addressing. The first one is that the these correctly coordinates, these the things that you get by introducing these auxiliary fields, aren't like active gauge transformations. And that's kind of a new concept. I mean, in gauge theory, we don't usually think of the gauge transformations as being active. But here they're active. We have this free endpoint variation.
Why do you say they're active here?
Because you're actually physically shifting the fields. You're moving. You're taking the configuration, and you're creating dynamic fields that are moving them. In a gauge theory,
but we those transformations are considered unphysical.
Yeah. So you can do it. I suppose the gauge fields, the gauge part of the gauge fields that you introduce is kind of like an active gauge transformation in a way. So maybe I should take this point off. But maybe I should take this point off.
Is it meant to be a mathematical distinction you're pointing to, or a distinction in the interpretation of this transformation? Because I don't see a distinction in the interpretation, but maybe I'm missing some important mathematical.
I can't remember why I put this on. I don't think this is actually crucial, so why don't we just ignore this? Or maybe scratch it off. Literally scratch it off. The thing that is important is there's this. I think that, because there was a question asked last time, is this an active gauge transformation or passive? And I said, no, it's an active. These are real fields. So maybe that part is just trying to understand that. But once you understand what you're actually doing, there is no distinction to gauge theory. Other than, so one thing that I could mention is that it's curvature free. So really what we're doing is if you think of it in the language of gauge theory, you're creating a gauge connection that is always has pure gauge degrees of freedom. It doesn't have physical degrees of freedom. Because the physical degrees of freedom would be doing stuff that would be physical, which is not what you want in this case. Although it is an interesting possibility to see that. There's a free endpoint variation, which implies this thing and this thing equal to zero separately. So normally these are in the Euler Lagrange equations. This guy has a derivative in front of them. The derivative of this guy would be equal to this guy. But with the free endpoint variation, you have a new type of thing where these two guys have to be satisfied simultaneously. So that's a very different thing. And what we looked at only this condition. And this is the thing that gave us the phase constraint. It's this thing that gave us, that led to these constraints. So these things give us linear constraints. What about this guy? I didn't even really talk about him. So that's hopefully what we'll be able to get back today. So what is this guy doing? In fact, this guy is going to be a requirement of global gauge invariance of the action. And it's this thing that's going to put restrictions on the potential. The other thing that's weird, the other thing is we called the momenta Pi equals Mi times Qi. We saw this quantity here, we called it the momentum. And then we saw these other quantities that we defined as the angular momentum and the dilatational momentum. But we didn't really justify. We didn't say these are true momenta. They're canonical variables that are conjugate to various things. So in the Hamiltonian formulation, we're going to be able to say really that these things are truly momenta, and what they mean and what they are.
Could it be Q and cons?
Oh, yeah, of course. Sorry. the last thing is we made this gauge choice. When we looked at our equations, when we tried to interpret them, we made a gauge choice. That was kind of funny. It said omega dot alpha is equal to zero. And it's kind of a weird thing to do to introduce these omega dots and then take variations with respect to them. And then at the end of the day, just set them equal to zero. So really what their role is to impose these constraints and the constraints on the potential. But then once they've done that, we just get rid of them. So it's kind of a weird thing to do. So it's worth actually checking that this is a legitimate gauge choice to think. And also that, is this, what is this gauge degree of freedom that we have in our theory? And is it generated by a first class constraint? What's the structure of it? So those are these are the things, maybe not this guy, but these are the things we're going to be able to address using, using the Hamiltonian formula. Okay, so.
Sean.
Yeah.
How is P equal to the mass times the velocity unfamiliar?
It is familiar, right? It's but it's I mean that's why we just said, oh, this is the moment we have a Newtonian. But this is not Newtonian theory, right? So this is Newtonian theory with these new omegas and stuff in it. So it's not clear whether or not the P's that we're going to define the momentum that we're going to get that are conjugate to the Q's are going to be exactly that form. And in fact, they're not. They're only of this form when you in this particular gauge. So so it's not an unfamiliar concept, of course. But the reason why I put it in this list of sort of ideas that you have to kind of get used to is that the momentum is not just defined as this. It's, it has a specific definition within the canonical framework. And we should check to make sure that this thing that we call momentum is actually momentum. That's all. Same thing with the angular momentum. So this is the canonical framework. And I think you can get a lot of useful information from this. But of course, there's a little bit more mathematical details. And I wanted to talk about this physical stuff before just losing yourself in the math. So here's the Barber-Bertotti action that we wrote down last time. There's a kinetic energy, a square root of the kinetic energy. But instead of evaluating at the Q, it's this covariant derivative with this piece here. So we've added a new piece of the kinetic energy, we take the square root, and then we still have minus b. And what I'll do, just to make it easier, is I'll absorb the e into the b. So I'll say that this is really equal to e minus b, but for now we're just not writing the zero term of the potential. We're just not right for now. We'll just assume that we can extract So this is the action that we're starting with. And then what we do is we define the canonical momenta the pi that's canonically conjugate to the q is given by this. And we can calculate that. The only dependence this action has in the q dots is the kinetic energy. And you need to bring down factor of t. So we get this factor of root v over t evaluated at this covariant derivative. I'm just going to write it like that so we know that. So I don't have to write this whole term. What we're left with, you get a half canceling this q from the square root. And then what we're left with is just
T is everything inside the quadratic?
Yeah, this is the kinetic energy that I call T. And maybe it's because I made that definition earlier than focusing on. T is everything in the is this kinetic energy function, but it's evaluated at this new value of Q, I can find more of which. What's a good color? Is yellow a good color?
Yeah.
Yellow would be better than anything else.
Yeah. So there's a couple of really small guys, but So the term that we have, the piece we're left with is this thing here, and that's it. So that's good, that's the definition of piece. Doesn't quite look like this, right? Instead of a dot, there's a V over T times D by D lambda of Q. Now, for those of you who weren't here, earlier in the course, we had this ephemeris time, whose definition was T dot is equal to T over E minus V, or just, I guess, VVO. So this factor here, combined with this derivative, is looking a little bit like ephemeris time, like a derivative with respect to this relational time. And then in the gauge where this is zero, then we get something that looks like this. Okay? So that's the sort of relationship between this momentum and the Newtonian momentum that we see. But I need to show that that's really true gauge shows. Now, we can also find the momenta conjugate to the omegas. So I'll call them pi with alphas at the bottom. And they're equal to the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the omega dots. So there's only one occurrence of omega dot, it's right here. So we get the same factor of V over T. But then instead of only picking out one term, we pick out all the terms. And we have this leftover piece here. So it looks like minus V over T of D omega Q. But now we have a sum over all I of Mi Q dot I. And now we have this extra piece, T alpha and Q alpha.
Sean, there are all omega dots in the actuals, right?
Did I screw it up?
Well, it's just that
it's just hard to see. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, this omega dot in the action. And this is an omega dot. Maybe I'll draw a regular in the circles. This is a dot, this is a dot. This is Q. So we have this extra piece. But if you look, right, this thing times this is just the momentum behind the particle. So don't want to say that right away. Yeah. So now we have some constraints. And the first constraint looks like this. I'll call it L alpha. And it looks like the pi alphas are just equal to the sum of the momenta, right? So the sum over I, pi, times this little piece here, right? T alpha qi equals zero. Okay? So this is the thing that says that this is the angular momentum. So I went through this last time, but this thing here is the thing that looks like the generalized momentum. Okay. So for translations, for rotations, remember the T alphas were just epsilon, they're the generators of the groups, so they're epsilon I, j, k. So what you have is P cross, so that implies P cross P. So the angular momentum. For the rotation, for the translations, these guys are derivatives with respect to Q. So those derivatives will hit this guy, and they'll leave you only with PIs. It's the momentum. For the scale transformations, the T alphas are delta functions, in which case this is a dot product. PI dot Q. Okay. So this guy is the generalized moment. That we called it the generalized. And now it's saying that that minus this momentum is equal to zero. And I call this linear constraints. There are linear constraints on momentum. Okay? So, probably running out of chocolate. Now, there's a second type of constraint, and this is going to address this point right here. Because with the free F1 variation, you have this condition that dy eb dy is equal to zero. In the canonical framework, this thing is the definition of momentum conjugate to the auxiliary fields. So this guy in the canonical framework is just a constraint on the momentum. So I can just spot this because they're important. Pi epsilon is equal to zero. And this is what I call a Mach constraint. If you remove this constraint, then you just have this thing. And what it says is that and this guy winds up being constant. We'll show that later. But this thing becomes a constant, and this generalized momentum is a conserved quantity. That's this constraint's tolerance. When we add the Mach constraint, it's restricting a set of solutions to ones where this generalized momentum is equal to zero. So this is the thing that's really making your theory relational, background independent. And the gauge invariance generated by this constraint is something that is creating the background. So Mach constraint. And the last one is one that we had when we had our original Jacobi theory, which is just a Hamiltonian constraint. So this thing is a constraint. It looks like the sum over all the PIs squared over 2mi plus v equals zero. So we can check if this is true. It's not as trivial as it was in the other case. I think P's definition of P is going to be okay. So the square of this is going to bring in a factor of this square. So minus V over T times sum over I of one factor of M survives on top over 2 times Q dot I dot plus omega dot alpha T alpha Q I squared. Note that this is just equal to the kinetic energy T of D omega Q. So this guy will cancel on this guy. And then we have plus B zero. So that was simpler than that. Okay. That was fairly easy to check. It's the other one that takes a lot. So so this thing is really a constraint in theory. And it's exactly the same form that it was before we implemented spatial relations. So this thing is the scalar. It's a quadratic. The thing that's interesting about this is it's quadratic in P, which is unusual. It's a really different type of constraint. Scalar, Hamiltonian string. And this is the thing that's analogous to the scalar constraint you get in general relativity. So that's why that's interesting. It's related to the reparameterization difference of the action. So we have these constraints. It's really easy now to work out the some brackets. So we have these constraints. We need to check that these constraints are actually commuting themselves. So that the Poisson brackets and the different constraints are zero. If they're not zero, the first thing we need to check is what the canonical Hamiltonian is. Then we have to check that the constraints are commuting with the Hamiltonian. Because if they're not, what it means is that the equations of motion won't be preserving, won't be keeping you on the constraint surface. So the evolution might take you away from the constraint surface. In which case, if those Poisson brackets are non-zero, then you have to impose secondary constraints, and make sure those secondary constraints, now that new system is closed. So we'll go through that a little bit. But luckily, that shouldn't take us too long. So the first thing that we need to check is what is the Hamiltonian. So the canonical Hamiltonian is the sum over pi times qi dot plus omega dot alpha times pi alpha. So this is, we're doing the Hamiltonian is a Lagrange transform of the Lagrangian. So this is the part of the Lagrange transform, and then you subtract this by the Lagrangian. Okay. Then the idea is that you're supposed to be able to invert the definitions of the p's in terms of the q dots, and then write this whole thing in terms of just the canonical variables, p's and q's, no q dots inside. But for our purposes, we don't actually need to do that. We can just plug in the definitions, what we're going to see is that this is going to be equal to zero. Which is always the case whenever you have a reparameterization invariant theory in the canonical variable. So this is a generic feature, but let's just show that this is true. If we plug in our definitions of the momentum, we get sum over I of we have an overall factor of minus b over t. Okay. Sum over I of m I times q dot I omega alpha dot t alpha q I times q dot I. So this is the momentum. Then we have plus, now we can use the definitions that we have here. That's going to be minus b over t sum over I and I q dot I plus omega dot I. Now t alpha. I should probably not use alpha twice. I'll just get beta. But if you look at this, all right, minus the plunging. If you look at this, okay, you have this Q dot multiplying this thing. And then you have this omega dot alpha T alpha Q multiplying the same thing. And you can see that this guy plus this guy is just this guy again. So really what this, when you add these two terms, what you have is you have minus B over T times the sum over I and I of this thing. Square. Okay. Now, this is twice the kinetic energy. 2 times T. 2 times T divided by the square root of T is going to give you 2 times the square root of T times the square root of minus B. This was our original action. So, minus 2 to the square root of t is 0. Okay, so Hamiltonian Hamiltonian 0, which is what we want. And so now what we can show is that the total Hamiltonian, so for those of you who are unfamiliar with this, it seems strange. Our Hamiltonian is identically equal to 0. So how are we going to get any evolution at all? Well, we have these constraints, which are also equal to 0. But they're only equal to 0 when the equations of motion have been applied, right? So what we can do is we can write a Hamiltonian, a total Hamiltonian, which is proportional to the constraints. So now our total Hamiltonian is going to be some arbitrary Lagrange multiplier, which is some function of the p's and the q's, okay, multiplied by the Hamiltonian constraint, plus some other arbitrary function, which is also arbitrary function of p's and q's, times the linear constraint, plus some other arbitrary function of p's and q's, times the mod constraint. This is our new Hamiltonian. So now, if the constraints commute with each other, then they'll commute with the Hamiltonian. So what we need to do, all we need to do is check that the constraints commute with each other. That is, the plus or brackets of the constraints call zero. So let's check that. There's two that are really easy to check. The Hamiltonian constraint with the Mach constraint. Oh, wait. Before I do this, I should define the fundamental Poisson brackets. So the Poisson brackets between these guys. So this is the fact that these are canonical variables. We define them that way, so that their Poisson brackets should give delta functions, delta I, ij, times an identity matrix. Right? Because this is a call that this program, so this is identity matrix, and also the omega alphas with the pi's should be delta alpha theta. Okay. So now, using those fundamental Poisson brackets, we can compute the Poisson brackets of the constraints with themselves. So the first one to write down, which is trivial, is this guy. So we have a sum over pi squared. It's a potential. The potential is a function of the q's. But the only thing that the pi's don't commute with is omegas. And there's no omegas in here. So this is 0. Similarly, the linear constraints of the pies are going to look like I alpha minus P's dot of Q's. This pi beta. But again, because there are no omegas in this, this thing is just zero. So far, so good. The last one is the one that is going to give us some problems. It's the Hamiltonian constraint with the linear constraints. So you can kind of maybe start to see what's going to happen. Is that now you have I alpha minus this term is fine, don't worry about it. But this piece is not going to commute with this piece. Right? You have p's, they're not going to commute with these q's. Then you have p's, they're not going to commute with these q's. It's fairly easy to work out, because the Poisson brackets are just like taking derivatives. You have to get the minus signs right away. So we have an overall minus sign. So the first thing is, why don't I try to commute this piece with this piece? If I do that, I get a derivative of the potential with respect to the QIs, because of this Q with this guy here. But I'm left with a piece that looks like T alpha QI. Because this Q is Q, right? So I have a piece that looks like this, but I have an overall minus sign. So there's a minus here. And there should be a sum over all particles. So sum over all particles is minus sign. Now we also, so the second term is this guy with this guy. So it's just like taking the derivative of Q with respect to Q, and we get the 2 coming down. So we have a term that looks like there's going to be a positive because the P is on this side of the Q, so you get a minus sign from Q. But then there's an overall minus sign here, which means a plus sign. And this looks like pi at t alpha in the middle, and then another pi like this over mi. And we lose the factor of 2, because there's 2 pieces of this. And that's supposed to be equal to 0. Okay, so this thing is supposed to be equal to 0. That's weird, right?
So that's how you get the constraint.
So this, in principle, will be a secondary constraint. But what we can do is we can treat this as a constraint on V. So if V is of a particular form, this will automatically be satisfied. And then we don't have to worry about the having secondary constraints. So this algebra closes for particular types of potentials. And so this is our Julian problem, consistency conditions. Although my notation is so far, so different from the notation it uses that you might not recognize it. This is consistency conditions. So what type of, maybe let's just add, oh, okay. So maybe I should stop there. But this is the thing that's going to effectively give us this piece. Right? The vanishing of this is equivalent to the vanishing of this guy. And the way you can see that is that this is the thing that's needs to be zero in order for the equations of motion to propagate the constraints. So this is related to the equations of motion, the Euler-Lagrange equations, and this is the term you get from the Euler-Lagrange equations once you have them off the constraints. apply. So, and we'll go into this next time, but this thing is the thing that's telling you that the Lagrangian should be invariant under a global gauge transformation. So any Lagrangians that are invariant under these global gauge transformations will satisfy this condition. And for rotations and translations, all it's going to mean is that the potential will, that condition will be satisfied when the potential is of this form. It's a function of the distances between the particles. The potential is a function of the distances between the particles. Then this equation is satisfied, and you're okay. So, so it's kind of nice. Because we didn't impose this from the start, but what we're finding is that in order for the algebra to be closed, in order for the system to be consistent, we need to have potentials in this form. So that's very, it's kind of nice. In normal gauge theory, you start with a action that's globally gauge invariant, and then you start deriving things. Here it actually comes out of the formulas. So in a lot of ways, you can't really get this from gauge theory. So that's an interesting comment. But I'll talk more about that next. And I'll also go into the specific details of how you get from there to here. Because I think they're interesting and important. So any questions?
You don't get the fact that it's 1 over the distances squared from this constraint?
So this condition for the scale transformation, so when the T alphas are just delta functions, then you get that V needs to be 1 over R ij squared.
So the V being a function of the distances is a consequence of applying that for translations and rotations?
Translations, rotations, and scale transformations.
Scale transformations gives you the second one.
Yeah, the rotations, so this is rotations
plus
translation.
Right.
And this is, in addition, scale.
And rotations or translations alone give you what?
Just this. Rotations and translations alone. Oh, individually?
Yeah, individually.
So the rotations tell you that the potential has to be a function of the difference. Which, I mean, it makes sense, right? The difference is between the vectors, because the translations are not going to that quantity. The rotations are going to be distances, because the distances of the are unchanged by the rotations. So the combination of the two is this, and then this guy is this for scale.
An intuitive reason for the third? I can sort of see the first bit, but no.
As far as I can tell, there's no intuitive reason. It comes to, you get this equation, you get this differential equation that is like Euler's theorem. Although if you Google Euler's theorem, you get like 10 different theorems, right? But there is like some equation that Euler looked at where you can make statements about the order of these. The other thing that you can do is you can expand the power series, which I have done, but I'm not going to go for it. Which you can show that you can sort of match orders of that expansion and we find that this is the only non zero term. So it's interesting. The reason why you don't get this from gauge theory is because you don't do, instead of having a dot in the action, your connections are not dots. I don't know where my action is. But instead of having a dot, you have no dot. And then you do a so basically the rule of this is replaced by this. And then you don't do a free endpoint variation. So in order for this to be equivalent to gauge theory, you need to have gauge invariance to start with. Because what that's going to do is it's going to make it these equations of motion equivalent. Because the gauge invariance is going to be something like this is equal to zero. So then your other term in your Lagrangian equation is also going to be zero. That's because of gauge invariance. So that's the thing that makes the two variation principles equivalent. So it's kind of like interesting that Julian started with this idea and had this free endpoint variation, and then it's equivalent to gauge theory, but only because, you know, this interesting trick where the derivative is swappable, so you get gauge invariants. So from gauge theory, you need to have gauge invariants to start. But here you don't, you kind of divide it. At the end of the day, you can do, because why else would you do this in the first place? But you didn't have any symmetries, but still, it's kind of, you know, I think the philosophy is very different, and the formalism affects that. But the other thing that you can't do in gauge theory is you can't set the Mach constraint, you can't lift the Mach constraint. So you have actually some interesting, some new sort of thing that you can do in this theory. You lift the Mach constraint, and now you have something that's totally different from something you could have had from the gauge theory action. And I'm going to claim that lifting the Mach constraint is the thing that gets you the background back. So that might be interesting. And especially when we're talking about Jerome. So, anyways, those are some new questions. Yeah?
Could this theory conform to gravity?
Yeah, it's just like a non-strip gravity. Yeah.
So the action is like the file tensor contracting it. I was just wondering, kind of Newtonian, that if that would be one for us.
I don't know for sure, but it. It's interesting.
I just wonder if maybe that's the only one you can write down without introducing the dimension of constant.
Well, see, general relativity looks a little bit different from this, right? This particular form of the potential is derived from the equations of motion. In general relativity, you have a four-dimensional field. So this version of the equation is quite a bit more complicated, and the solution is maybe not this simple. So there is like a scale invariant gravity theory. I don't know if it's equivalent to conformal gravity. It might be, because that scalar invariant gravity has 1 degree of freedom. And this is just a scalar, right? The metric is just a conformal factor. And then this Julian scalar invariant gravity is also only has 1 degree of freedom because you add this extra constraint at every point in space and time. So it could be that they're the same theory, but I'm not, I mean, you have to check the details.
Does that mean no gravitational waves?
Yeah, there is no. There's only that. There's something. It's something very different in general. This stuff is exciting because you can make quite a few connections to general relativity. Like, the mini superspace is almost identical to this theory. The linear constraints are the things that are significant ones. These things combined with the Mach constraint probably would be constraints in general. They don't look the same, it's not totally obvious.